October 6th, 2023, 17:27 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green here with you for our study, for today's scriptural study and study in the Born and Raised article, which we've been studying for some time now. Actually, we're up to paragraph 5 of chapter 8, so we've done a lot of this article, well past the halfway mark. And chapter 8, paragraph 5 says, in the prophetic sense, the Messiah was supposed to do some works of healing on the sixth day before the end of the system of things could arrive or Sabbath begin. The Sabbath of 1,000 years, or judgment day. Remember, a day is like 1,000 years to God, Jehovah. So judgment day could thus be considered, as we saw in Joseph and On, which is one of my articles, Joseph and On. It's the one that came after Joseph, as a period beginning about 400 years after Jesus. After that millennial Sabbath, the Renaissance began in 1452 CE. That's our era. We're in the year 2023. That's 1452. Leonardo da Vinci was born, and he typified the Renaissance perhaps more than anyone of that time. Attila, he's the one called Attila the Hun, died in 453 CE, 1,000 years before 1453 CE, when the city of Byzantium, or Constantinople, or Istanbul, fell. The Jewish system of temple worship ended in 70 CE, as we have seen. And the general congruence of events and the timeline itself show us that Jesus is the Messiah. His resurrection, as importantly, is a guarantee to us that Jesus will be alive forever to help us, and that a resurrection is coming, after which all will be judged. Just as the Jewish system ended, so will also the evil system of today's world pass away by a spiritual fire. This is our hope, and it strengthens us and brings joy to us Christians. So, you know, people say, well, the world seems to be going on and it never changes. But this is our hope, that the evil aspects, you know, the evil part of today's world, the systems of evil throughout the world that are causing all kinds of problems for everybody, violence, you know, warfare, but all kinds of abusive behavior that's running throughout the world's systems, the world's organizations, let's say, that evil must be done away with, and so those organizations are to be done away with is the hope that we have, right? That's the hope. It's the only way to make the world better, is to do away with the evil. And so, in fact, is that also the hope that we have as Christians? And Jesus is always going to be alive. He's got eternal life now after he's been resurrected. He's not going to die again. He'll always be there to help. So it's prepared. It's ready. Things are prepared in heaven, as we saw when we were reading the book Revelation, right, in the Bible. We saw that there were a lot of things prophesied that were going to take place in the end time, which the final days of this system of things in the final judgment. And it was described in great detail in Revelation, in a very symbolic way too, of course. But we saw that. We just finished recently studying that. Today's proverb, little children, is from Proverbs chapter 29 and 10. Bloodthirsty men hate anyone blameless, and as for the upright ones, they keep seeking for the soul of each one. For the soul of each one. Bloodthirsty men hate anyone blameless, and as for the upright ones, they keep seeking for the soul of each one. That's interesting, because is it the upright ones who are seeking for the soul of the bloodthirsty men, or is it the bloodthirsty men who are seeking for the souls of the upright ones? It is not entirely definitive there. We could see it both ways. But the upright ones seek for the soul in a good sense by trying to help to convert the other people who are not righteous to being righteous people, to being loving. So the upright ones are seeking the soul in a good way, but of course the bloodthirsty men are seeking for the soul of the upright ones to destroy the upright ones. That's the difference. And bloodthirsty men hate the blameless, as it says also. So that's our proverb for today. Now, we're coming now to the last book of the last chapter, I should say, of the book of Joshua. The very last chapter of Joshua is where we are now. Little ones. We're completing that book, hopefully, now, today. And so this is something to pay attention to, because after Joshua, the book will be then chapter 1 of Judges, if we continue in that series. And that's a fascinating book, because we've been already recently studying the chronology of the book of Judges. So perhaps we would look at that next. I'm not sure yet. But look at what happens in the final book of Joshua. Let's consider that, shall we? And Joshua proceeded to assemble all the tribes of Israel together at Shechem, and to call the older men of Israel and its heads and its judges and its officers. And they went taking their stand before the true God. And Joshua went on to say to all the people, "This is what Jehovah, the God of Israel, has said. It was on the other side of the river that your forefathers dwelt a long time ago," meaning the Euphrates River. That's in the land of Mesopotamia, right far away in the land in which the city of Ur was located, "that your forefathers dwelt a long time ago, Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they used to serve other gods." But of course, they also dwelt in the north at Haran, and that's, I believe that's also on the other side of the Euphrates River as well. So we could consider that as meaning that they dwelt in Haran. What's the asterisk? Do we have that here? Oh, 24 and 2. Yeah, it's the other side of the river. It's the Euphrates, of course, as we just said. But this, on the other side of the river, could mean that they dwelt up north in Haran. They had to travel quite a distance to get to Canaan. But, of course, before that, they dwelt in Ur, the city of Ur in Mesopotamia, which is further east, much further east, in the land where eventually, and originally Nimrod had built the Tower of Babel, right? Or he'd been involved in that land wherein the Tower of Babel had been located, I should say. And it wasn't Nimrod who built the Tower of Babel, was it? I don't think it was. But they had, the Tower of Babel had been built in that same land of Mesopotamia, Shinar, it's called, also. That was the land where later Nebuchadnezzar would rule also. In that, it's the land called Mesopotamia. It was called Babylon at some point. It was called Assyria at different times. And the Chaldeans are from there, or from that region. They were from the north, actually, I believe. But Nebuchadnezzar was from the people called Chaldeans. They all dwelt at different times. That was the place in Babylon, as it was later called. And that was on the other side of the river, too. And they used to serve other gods. In time, I took your forefather. This was the ancestors of Abraham, though. His father, Terah, and his brother, Nahor. They all served other gods long before Nebuchadnezzar was ever on the scene. In time, I took your forefather, Abraham, from the other side of the river and had him walk through all the land of Canaan, and made his seed many. So I gave him Isaac. Then to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. Later to Esau I gave Mount Seir to take possession of it. And Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt. Do you remember that, little ones? Later on I sent Moses and Aaron, and I went plaguing Egypt with what I did in its midst. And afterward I brought you out. When I was bringing your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea, then the Egyptians went chasing after your fathers with war chariots and cavalry men to the Red Sea, and they began to cry out to Jehovah, that is, the fathers of the Israelites. So he placed a darkness between you and the Egyptians and brought the sea upon them and covered them. And your eyes got to see what I did in Egypt, and you took up dwelling in the wilderness many days. That was the 40 years that they spent dwelling in the wilderness. Eventually, I brought you to the land of the Amorites, who were dwelling on the other side of the Jordan, and they went fighting against you. At that, I gave them into your hand, that you might take possession of their land, and I annihilated them from before you. Then Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, got up and went fighting against Israel. So he sent and summoned Balaam, the son of Beor, to call down evil upon you. And I did not want to listen to Balaam. Consequently, he blessed you repeatedly. Thus, I delivered you out of his hand. Remember when Balaam blessed the Israelites continually? No matter where Balak took him to view them from a distance up on a mountain somewhere, he took them to different places to find a place where from which Balaam might be able to execrate Israel, and he couldn't do it. He couldn't say anything bad about them. On the contrary, he blessed them very much. Then, verse 11, you, meaning the Israelites, went crossing the Jordan and came to Jericho. And the landowners of Jericho, the Amorites and the Perizzites, and the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Girgashites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, began fighting against you. But I gave them into your hand. That was Jericho. So I sent the feeling of dejection ahead of you, and it gradually drove them out before you. Two kings of the Amorites. Not with your sword and not with your bow. Thus I gave you a land for which you had not toiled, and cities that you had not built, and you took up dwelling in them. Vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant are what you were eating. What you are now eating, he was saying to the Israelites, is not something you planted. It was already planted. Vineyards and olive groves that were planted by the former residents. And now fear Jehovah and serve him in faultlessness and in truth, and remove the gods that your forefathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt, and serve Jehovah. Now, if it is bad in your eyes to serve Jehovah, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods that your forefathers who were on the other side of the river served, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are dwelling. But as for me and my household, we shall serve Jehovah. At this the people answered and said, It is unthinkable on our part to leave Jehovah so as to serve other gods, for it is Jehovah our God who brought us and our fathers up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slaves, and who performed these great signs before our eyes, and who kept guarding us in all the way in which we walked, and among all the peoples through the midst of whom we passed. And Jehovah proceeded to drive out all the peoples, even the Amorites dwelling in the land, from before us. As for us too, we shall serve Jehovah, because he is our God. Then Joshua said to the people, You are not able to serve Jehovah, for he is a holy God. He is a God exacting exclusive devotion. He will not pardon your revolting and your sins. In case you should leave Jehovah and you do serve foreign gods, he also will certainly turn back and do you injury and exterminate you after he has done you good. In turn, the people said to Joshua, No, but Jehovah we shall serve. At this Joshua said to the people, You are witnesses against yourselves that you of your own accord have chosen Jehovah for yourselves to serve him. To this they said, We are witnesses. And now, Joshua continued, Remove the foreign gods that are among you and incline your hearts to Jehovah, the God of Israel. In turn, the people said to Joshua, Jehovah our God we shall serve, and to his voice we shall listen. Verse 25, And Joshua proceeded to conclude a covenant with the people on that day, and to constitute for them a regulation and judicial decision in Shechem. Then Joshua wrote these words in the book of God's law, meaning, of course, the book of Joshua, and took a great stone and set it up there under the massive tree that is by the sanctuary of Jehovah. And Joshua went on to say to all the people, Look, this stone is what will serve as a witness against us, because it has itself heard all the sayings of Jehovah that he has spoken with us, and it must serve as a witness against you, that you may not deny your God. With that, Joshua sent the people away, each one to his inheritance. And it came about that after these things, Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of Jehovah, gradually died at the age of 110 years. So they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath-Serah, which is in the mountainous region of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. And Israel continued to serve Jehovah all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the older men who extended their days after Joshua, and who had known all the work of Jehovah that he did for Israel. And Joseph's bones, which the sons of Israel had brought up out of Egypt, they buried in Shechem in the tract of the field that Jacob had acquired from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And it came to belong to the sons of Joseph as an inheritance. Also, Eleazar the son of Aaron died, so they buried him in the hill of Phinehas his son, which he had given him in the mountainous region of Ephraim. Okay, so Eleazar the son of Aaron died. So we've already seen the passing of two generations since they came out of Egypt. We saw Aaron and his son both pass away there, as of course did the brother of Aaron, Moses, also pass away. So it seems reasonable that this time period was about 1422, as we reckon it in the genealogy, when Joshua died, and that would be about 30 years after the death of Moses and the death of Aaron, of course. It was the same approximate time. So, as the time of the death of Moses, that is. So, it was about another 30 years, which is interesting, certainly. It's interesting that the son of Aaron died there, but also that Joshua died. Now, Joshua was younger than Moses, but and he was, how old was he at the time? Well, Caleb, we saw, was about, actually, he was said to be 40 years old when they spied out the land. Caleb was, but how old Joshua was at that time? Well, Joshua died at the age of 110, right? There it is, verse 29. Right, so therefore, we don't know what year this chapter is written, perhaps, but if it is in, well, we do know actually, in our genealogy, we have it dated as 1422. So 1422, we could add the 110 years, and we get 1532 for the, which is 40 years younger than Moses, who was born in 1572 in the genealogy, so, or very close to that. So that's, that means, yeah, Joshua was about 40 then when they spied out the land, or perhaps he was about 42 years old when they spied out the land, that would say. We can actually calculate the ages of these people, biblical characters now, because we have the genealogy, which is, it will enable us, it doesn't necessarily enable us right now, it will enable us to make all kinds of different evaluations of different kinds of, you know, what demographics, let's say, you know, ages of people, and help us to study the lives of the Israelites back in those times, in the years of 1452 to 1422 BCE. Joshua then having ruled or judged Israel for about 30 years at the time of his death, from 1452 to 1422. And that number 30 years is one of the numbers that's given in the Jewish written records or traditions, perhaps even, it's close to the number that Josephus gives, I'm trying to remember, but it'll be talked about. It is in one of our articles already. It may be in the, I'm trying to think, is it Preservation or the one before that? But it's in one of the articles that we talk about how long Joshua ruled. Let's go on, though. Today, we'll have to deal with some of these things at a later date, on a different occasion, because we can't talk about everything every single day. But it's in, what was the one before Preservation? What's the article before Preservation? All we have to do is take our new article, go down to the bottom, right? And when we get to the bottom, go to the end, scroll up, and take a look at what the order of the articles was, right? And then we see True, and we see Preservation was the one before this one. Born and Raised is the one we're in. Preservation was before that. And then True was talking about. So I think it's in Preservation. I think it's in the B article, number 17. That's where we talk about how long. I'm fairly certain that that's where we talked about the time period during which Joshua judged Israel. So we talk about much more there than we do in this article, because this article is about Jesus Christ, the one we're studying now, born and raised. But we're also studying the Bible, and here's 1 Peter, the second chapter. So Peter goes on to say, what did he say in chapter 1? How did he conclude that? Yeah, this has been declared as good news to you. The idea, of course, of Jehovah's word enduring forever, and we have hope because of the resurrection of Christ, he says in verse 21. we have hope in God, because God can resurrect Jesus, then he can resurrect us. Chapter 2 of 1 Peter says now, accordingly, put away all badness and all deceitfulness and hypocrisy and envies and all sorts of backbiting. And as newborn infants, form a longing for the unadulterated milk belonging to the Word, that through it you may grow to salvation, provided you have tasted that the Lord is kind. Coming to him as to a living stone, rejected, it is true, by men, but chosen, precious with God, you yourselves also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house for the purpose of a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For it is contained in Scripture, look, I am laying in Zion a stone, chosen, a foundation cornerstone, precious, and no one exercising faith in it will by any means come to disappointment. It is to you, therefore, that he is precious, because you are believers. But to those not believing, the identical stone that the builders rejected has become the head of the corner, and a stone of stumbling, and a rock mass of offense. These are stumbling because they are disobedient to the word. To this very end, they were also appointed. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for special possession, that you should declare abroad the excellencies of the one that called you out of the darkness into his wonderful light. For you were once not a people, but are now God's people. You were those who had not been shown mercy, but are now those who have been shown mercy. Beloved, I exhort you as aliens and temporary residents to keep abstaining from fleshly desires, which are the very ones that carry on a conflict against the soul. Maintain your conduct fine among the nations, that in the thing in which they are speaking against you as evildoers, they may, as a result of your fine works, of which they are eyewitnesses, glorify God in the day for his inspection. For the Lord's sake, subject yourselves to every human creation, whether to a king as being superior, or to governors as being sent by him to inflict punishment on evildoers, but to praise doers of good. For so the will of God is, that by doing good you may muzzle the ignorant talk of the unreasonable men. Be as free people, and yet holding your freedom, not as a blind for badness, but as slaves of God. Honor men of all sorts. Have love for the whole association of brothers. Be in fear of God. Have honor for the king. Let house servants be in subjection to their owners with all due fear, not only to the good and reasonable, but also to those hard to please. For if someone, because of conscience toward God, bears up under grievous things and suffers unjustly, this is an agreeable thing. For what merit is there in it, if when you are sinning and being slapped, you endure it? But if when you are doing good and you suffer, you endure it, this is a thing agreeable with God. In fact, to this course you were called, because even Christ suffered for you, leaving you a model for you to follow his steps closely. He committed no sin, nor was deception found in his mouth. When he was being reviled, he did not go reviling in return. When he was suffering, he did not go threatening, but kept on committing himself to the one who judges righteously. He himself bore our sins in his own body upon the stake, in order that we might be done with sins and live to righteousness. And by his stripes you were healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. And that's the end of 1 Peter chapter 2. When he was suffering, Christ did not go threatening. He kept on committing himself to the one who judges righteously. In other words, keep on thinking about Jehovah and his name. Remember Jehovah. There's a lot of power in the name Jehovah. Call upon the name of Jehovah continually. When you're being tried, and you will be saved. through the name alone, because there's a lot of power in the name of Jehovah. The name itself, of course, means he causes to become. So it is nothing but a powerful name in itself. And he is the personification of love. So when we become something, it means we become obviously better. Obviously, we couldn't be becoming anything if we didn't improve. So it's all about becoming better. And when we're tried, we can call upon Jehovah for help to become better. But it's similar to what Jesus did, because he didn't go threatening. He committed himself to Jehovah. And he bore the sins of all of us among mankind, all the sins of mankind, upon his own body. In his own body, he bore those sins. Upon the stake, which is a remarkable thing, because all the sins get put upon the one who is without sin. The one who is without sin is the one who gets blamed for everything. In other words, all the sin of mankind falls upon the perfect man, and that was Jesus. Adam didn't live up to that, the title of perfect man. It was not fulfilled by the first man, Adam, although he could have been a perfect man if he'd remained faithful, but he wasn't and didn't, and therefore he could not live up to this idea of being a perfect man. And therefore, but if he had not sinned, of course, there would have been no need for any second perfect man such as Jesus to come along. But we needed Jesus because he needed to carry the sins of mankind in his own body, so that when he was executed on the stake, when he died, all the sin would die as well, and all of the sin of mankind would be done away with. And that's the principle by which we are healed. The ransom sacrifice of Jesus. We're just down to the last few seconds here. So Jesus suffered. But look what also Peter says. He says, you know, abstain from fleshly desires in verse 11. What does that mean? You know, obviously we don't abstain from hunger. If we're hungry, we do eat. We don't completely abstain from that. But to set our minds on the things of the flesh, such as in Romans 8 and 5, those who are in accord with the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh. That's what Romans 8 and 5 says. So that's the end of the study for today. Okay? That's it. It's October 6th, 2023. It's 18:01 hours Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green, and I love you. And this is, in my behalf, Crow. And his partner, her partner, Cassie, saying bye for now.